Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Imagine ancient humans staring up at the night sky. Beaming in a sea of darkness and stars, they see something with a reddish hue.
Oh, we've been obsessed with Mars from a distance for thousands of years, mostly because of the fact that Mars stands out as a easily distinguished object in the night sky because of its color.
That's Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia.
So as long as we've been looking up at the night sky and could see and identify this interesting red object, we've been entranced with it.
The reddish hue reminded the Romans and Greeks of blood. They named the planet after their gods of war, Ares for the Greeks and Mars for the Romans. That name stuck. But rather than war or spilled blood, it's the possibility of life on that faraway planet that has mesmerized people.
Now, why do we want to go to Mars, actually? We really want to go to Mars because it's so much like Earth.
Mars is about half the size of Earth. It has about a third of the gravitational pull. It's cold, with freezing temperatures averaging 80 degrees below zero. The atmosphere is very thin, mostly carbon dioxide, very little oxygen. But still, compared to the other planets in our solar system, Derek says Mars is much more hospitable.
If we look back at the history of Mars, Mars, in its distant history, was much more like Earth was in its early history. So we think that there's a possibility that there was life on Mars at some point early on.
Or that we could live on Mars one day. Mars has inspired wild fantasies about distant civilizations and little green men. It put a spell on many observers trying to unlock the mysteries of the red planet. At its closest, Mars is nearly 40 million miles away from Earth, and we've tried for centuries to bridge that distance, from telescopes to flybys and probes. What are we learning about Mars, and when can we expect humans to actually set foot on this planet? To get started, let's take a closer look at our obsession with life on Mars.
We've always imagined that the heavens are populated by intelligent beings, or at least that they might be.
That's Jordan Bim. He is a historian of science, technology, and medicine. He says people started to focus on Mars specifically in the late 19th century.
What I call sort of the later telescope era of Mars exploration, where you started to get some closer glimpses of the surface that had these sort of suggestive, ambiguous sightings. So things like different coloration that would come and go with the seasons. And that seemed to suggest to some people that there might be vegetation there. Humble, sort of like hardy lichens and mosses.
Then ideas about life on Mars got a whole lot more exciting. This happened during an opposition,
which is the once every 26 month alignment between Earth and Mars. And back in the telescope era, that meant once every 2 years, you get a really, really good look at the surface, and you would get this big push of news about Mars, because that's when all the astronomers would report their best sightings of the surface.
During the opposition of 1877, Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli noticed something.
Hey, I think I can see some lines on the surface, but I'm not really too sure what they're about.
Enter American astronomer Percival Lowell, Harvard-trained and
independently wealthy, so he was able to finance and build his own observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Passionate, completely dedicated, looking to push boundaries. Maybe a bit like an Elon Musk of his time. Lowell elevates the conversation about these lines on Mars to completely new heights.
Those lines are evidence of an extraterrestrial civilization.
He argues that these lines are really canals built by very smart Martians.
Punctilious in their precision, they outdo in method all attempts of freehand drawing to copy them.
He writes flowing narratives about this advanced Martian civilization.
Young Martians must be born mathematicians that never outgrow the faculty. In the second place, the system betrays a wonderful unity of purpose, for it girdles the planet from pole to pole. Race prejudice, national jealousy, individual endeavor are there all subordinated to the common good.
It's a pretty far jump from seeing some lines to, oh, here's this whole civilization and here's what they're doing. So how did we get there?
So this is an idea called cultural tracking. So look back at like the late 19th century and what was happening on Earth. That's when you had the Suez Canal being built. That's when the Panama Canal was being planned. The canals were something of interest at that time for us, for humans.
Lowell's idea that an advanced society lived on Mars fell out of favor in the early part of the 20th century. But the hope that Mars had plant life, at least some simple vegetation, stuck around. Until...
We're about to encounter the planet Mars with a spacecraft built here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
In July of 1965, NASA's Mariner 4 completed the first successful flyby and returned 21 pictures of the red planet back to Earth.
Well, I'll be damned. My gosh, you have amazing detail in there.
It was a technological feat to get those pictures, but what they revealed was a bit of a letdown.
The Mariner 4 pictures neither demonstrate nor preclude the possible existence of life on Mars.
The images just showed...
frozen, irradiated, arid, rarefied desert.
So were people bummed out? Was this like...
Yeah, they were. In 1965, NASA had only existed for maybe 7 years. And this was sort of their first big attempt to learn something about Mars. The first time we'd gotten anywhere close to it beyond a telescope. And, you know, there were lots of hopes that we could see, you know, forests or, you know, at least vegetation on the surface or something. And they were really disappointed, and they had to fight to keep the field alive.
Scientists had to push to keep Mars research going and fund it. What was their selling point? You know, so we're looking at these images, looks like, you know, just dirt, or doesn't look wildly exciting. So how did they sell this continued exploration?
That community of scientists is sort of goes by the name of exobiology, which stood for extraterrestrial biology. And these were academic molecular biologists and astronomers, mostly from academia, who then got funding from NASA. And one of the tools that they used was called a Mars jar.
They looked pretty much just like a pickle jar set up to replicate conditions on Mars.
So low pressure, low temperature, different atmospheric gas mixture, and then they would try and grow things inside there using terrestrial life forms like microbes, mosses, and lichens. And what they found is that some things actually could survive in there. And so even when the images of Mars returned these sort of disappointing pictures, these exobiologists pointed to their Mars jars with things growing inside and said, look, the microbes could still exist in Martian conditions. We need to go not fly by, not orbit Mars, but go down to the surface and look with a microbiology laboratory to see if anything is there.
Jordan is writing a book about these Mars jars and the fact that they were invented by a military astrobiology program. He says the military was not interested in big questions like, what's the origin of life? Or, are we alone?
They wanted to establish an extraterrestrial base on Mars for the United States Air Force. That was part of this sort of militarization of outer space that started in the 1950s, animated by the Cold War competition with the Soviet Union.
Wow, so they were going to set up shop up there.
That was the plan, yeah. There were plans to build a base on the moon, and these Mars jars were part of a plan for a base on Mars, and they wanted to see if there's life on Mars, could that life be used by us to fuel this extraterrestrial base? And I argue that that's a very instrumentalist, very sort of inhumane relationship with extraterrestrial life, that these Mars jars create any sort of microbe as something that we should use rather than something we should maybe leave alone, let have its own planet.
What do you hope we will learn about Mars in our lifetime? Like, what will future historians talk about?
That we figure out a way to go to Mars and explore Mars in a way that is more ethical and sort of more thoughtful than the ways we've been doing it in the past. And what I see right now is a rush to Mars. And what I hope is that cooler heads prevail and we, you know, we don't stop, we don't turn away from Mars, but we have a moment of deep introspection. And we see this as a chance, you know, not only to not repeat the mistakes of the past and sort of go to Mars in a sort of a colonialist mindset, but as a chance to actually go to Mars to investigate and determine if there was life there, if there could be life there, and then decide what could be done with it in a way that's not just, you know, finders keepers and might makes right and sort of manifest destiny.
Jordan Bim is a research fellow at the Stefanovich Institute on the Formation of Knowledge at the University of Chicago and Guggenheim Fellow at the National Air and Space Museum. One more note on our Mars Canal astronomer Percival Lowell. He continued his exploration of space until the end of his life.
Lowell dies, but his observatory lives on and actually accomplished some really, really important astronomy. For example, the planet, or what was formerly called the planet Pluto, was discovered there by Clyde Tombaugh in the 1930s.
By the way, Jordan is writing a book about the pretty disturbing history of the Mars Jar development, and you can hear a longer interview with him in a podcast extra. Just subscribe to The Pulse from WHYY wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Destination Mars. I'm Maiken Scott, and we're talking about the fascination with the red planet and what we're learning about it. After the flyby and the pictures, the next hope was to actually land on Mars. The Soviets managed to do so in 1971, but astronomer Derek Pitt says the success was short-lived. Very short-lived. It lasted only seconds. What happened after those seconds?
The spacecraft stopped communicating.
Oh.
Now, it's not just the Soviet Union that has failed spacecraft there. The European Union has failed spacecraft there. The United Kingdom has failed spacecraft there. The United States, of course, has spacecraft that have landed on Mars and have subsequently stopped operating.
So once somebody actually sets foot on Mars, they will find all these things, maybe?
Yes, indeed. One could actually have a real treasure hunt, if you like, searching around on the surface of Mars for all of the failed spacecraft that are there. And so there's a treasure trove of objects that could be found on the surface of Mars.
Could be the first theme park on Mars, maybe. Failed space exploration.
I think so.
But there have been several successful landings since then. NASA has a whole fleet of robotic labs on wheels.
Of the roving research labs that we have landed on the surface of Mars in the last decade, we've been able to gather incredible information about the early history of the planet. Two things have come out for certain about Mars. We do know that at one point, Mars was much warmer and much wetter than it is now. We know for sure that Mars had rivers, lakes, oceans, like we see rivers, lakes, and oceans here on Earth. We also have been able to clearly identify and understand that there were environments on Mars that would have been conducive to the development of life. So this clearly tells us that there is a strong possibility that there could have been life of some sort on Mars. And we also know that Mars looked much more like Earth does now in its early history.
But we are not bringing anything back, right? All the research takes place on site.
So far, the work that we've been doing has been to examine and test right on Mars. And we've been able to do a tremendous amount of identifying minerals and rock types and just about everything about the geology of Mars you could imagine that we could do without sending people. We've done tremendous work there, but we haven't brought anything back yet. That is part of a future mission to send samples of soil back to Earth for even greater study than could be done, of course, on Mars. You know, even though the rovers are tremendous in what they do autonomously and remotely, of course, we have much better lab facilities here on Earth that could allow us to learn even more. So it'd be great to bring some of that back to Earth, but that hasn't happened yet.
Derek Pitts is chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, a science museum and education and research center. Coming up on Destination Mars, more on the rovers, their promise and their limitations.
Because of the time delay, if we were to send a command to the rover, it could take anywhere from 2 minutes to 20 minutes to get that command there.
That's still to come.
Support for the Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports the Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse at WHYY. I'm Mike and Scott. We're learning a lot about Mars from the work done by rovers, remote labs on wheels that are directed by scientists here on Earth. So the people running the experiments are millions of miles away. And that distance really becomes an issue when something goes wrong. How do engineers fix the rovers when problems occur? Reporter Alan Yu looked into it.
One of Curiosity's key features is a drill that can collect samples of Martian rocks to see, for instance, if Mars has chemicals that could point to signs of life. These are results that people here on Earth are very interested in.
Well, NASA says the rover Curiosity's made another big discovery up on planet Mars. It has found molecules of water in the soil.
The Mars rover Curiosity found water in the very first sample it took on the planet's surface.
Evidence in the rocks from Curiosity is literally unassailable.
All those results come from the drill, taking rock samples to send to the science instruments. But in 2016, the drill stopped working. Megan Lin is a mechanical engineer and deputy project manager for Curiosity.
Some of the hardest things to troubleshoot on the rover are problems that are intermittent, meaning they don't happen all of the times, they just sort of pop up randomly.
This was one of those problems. To understand the problem, first you need to know how the drill works. The drill has a drill bit that makes holes that are a little smaller than a dime. And it has two prongs that hold the rock, or whatever it is Curiosity is drilling into, to keep it steady.
If you were going to drill something here on Earth, say you have a block of wood, you would hold the block of wood or clamp it to the table, and then push your hand down on the drill while it was drilling to be able to create that force that goes down in. Those prong preload tips are what the rover uses on the end of its arm to hold that rock down and hold it steady. And now you've created a nice stable workspace. It's almost like a drill press.
And because of this design, Curiosity also needs a feed mechanism to poke the drill bit out. There were some occasional problems with the feed mechanism getting stuck.
So that was a hard one to recreate here on Earth, because we could either have a working brake that opened and allowed us to move, or a fully closed brake. But it was hard to simulate something that was partial like that.
And all Megan and her colleagues could do is test different commands using a rover on Earth and send those commands to Curiosity to see what happens.
Because of the time delay, if we were to send a command to the rover, it could take anywhere from 2 minutes to 20 minutes to get that command there for the rover to execute it. And then another 2 to 20 minutes to get that command back. And it all depends on where Earth and Mars are in their cycles around the sun.
They work around that by sending a whole day's worth of activity to Curiosity at once, so they don't have to spend big chunks of time just waiting for commands to go through. So the fixes. They tried powering up the different motors that make the drill work to try to isolate the problem. Megan and her team spent months testing and trying again and again. And this meant months without any drilling or soil samples. Finally, they managed to get the drill to poke out again, but it still does not go in and out smoothly like it is supposed to. And they made a decision. If the drill is going to be stuck in one position, it would be better to have the drill stuck poking out rather than stuck inside.
When the drill's all the way in, the drill bit can't touch a rock. It's kind of hidden.
The engineers tested the drill and it still works. But there are two more problems. One, in this new position, it no longer has the two hands to hold whatever it's drilling steady.
Flexibility in this case is the bad side of things, because now your drill bit can move around on the rock a little bit, which can cause problems for robotic control.
Now it's like holding a drill with one hand. It can dangle and move around a little bit. It's not ideal, but this does mean Curiosity can drill and collect rock samples again. And this is how the drill works today. The other problem is about getting the rock samples out of the drill. The original design had a funnel and a sieve called the Chimera system to send the rock samples into the science instruments for testing. But that relied on the drill being able to move in and out. Emily Lakdawala wrote a book about the design and engineering of Curiosity, and she explains it like this.
Because the drill feed is now extended all the way out all the time, that funnel isn't lined up with Chimera anymore, and so the whole Chimera system is useless. It doesn't get used anymore. You can't portion out material, you can't sieve it, you can't deliver a fine portion or a coarse portion or any of those things.
The engineers did a lot of testing, and they landed on a solution. They could make the drill spin backwards to shake the samples out of the drill and into the science instruments.
It's not as accurate as it used to be. They'll get big chunks in with a small chunks. They can't ever truly know if they've delivered what they hope they do. They can't ever know beforehand how much material is actually stored inside the drill chamber. So there's a lot more uncertainty with the solution, but it is still enabling the rover to use its science instruments and to continue its science mission. It's better than nothing.
It took the engineers more than a year to come up with all that. Megan Lin again.
Because we can't touch the hardware on Mars, a lot of what's available to us in terms of fixing it is in software or in the procedures that we ourselves follow. So you'll see a lot of fixes to very mechanical problems are to use that instrument differently.
So it's less a repair and more like how can the engineers and scientists work around the problem to still do the science they want to do in a different way. And this is how engineers can fix problems with Curiosity at a distance. The hardware on Curiosity is more powerful than it really needs to be, just so it has some slack for engineers to draw on. For example, it has two computer systems when it could get by with just one. And having a second computer has proven useful.
Anytime you want to upload new flight software to your rover, you kind of want to have that capability of having two computers, because otherwise it's akin to doing brain surgery on yourself while you're still awake. It's really nice for a computer when you can kind of put it to sleep and do a full shutdown and upload your new flight software and test it out without that being your main brain that's operating.
The other bit of slack that engineers can draw on is their creativity. How can they use the existing equipment and the Martian environment to their advantage? This is a lot of work to put into fixing one drill, but right now, these rovers are all we have on the surface of Mars. Emily Lakdawala again.
The rovers are like extensions of ourselves. It's almost like another set of senses or an extension of your body into a place that humans can't ordinarily go.
Curiosity was supposed to last on Mars for 2 years. But thanks to the redundant designs and the engineers on Earth working on problems, it's now been there for almost a decade.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. You're listening to Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The rovers are the best thing we have going on Mars right now, and they've worked much better than many people had hoped. But astronomer Derek Pitt says things would move along much more quickly if we had people on site.
And that's because being there in person, the human mind can integrate disparate facts so much more quickly and use observations in situ to help come to conclusions much faster. But I think that the tantalizing part of the work that we're doing now is what's also driving us to create the technologies that we need to actually send explorers to Mars.
We're still far away from that. So many challenges have yet to be solved. Derek says, for starters, there are two really risky parts to the mission, the takeoff from Earth and the landing on Mars.
We, first of all, have to be able to get whatever mass we want to send off of the planet Earth. So we have to have rockets that are big enough to launch a payload of, you know, certain weight that carries the scientific equipment that we want to launch to Mars. Then the next thing we have to be able to do is figure out, how do we land that spacecraft on the surface of Mars? Now, this creates a really interesting problem. The atmosphere of Mars is thick enough to present some problems in terms of how you come through without either breaking apart or burning up, but it's not thick enough to provide enough braking for the spacecraft to slow it down just using the atmosphere. So now you have to resort to some other method. And what has been used are parachutes to begin the initial slowdown as the spacecraft descends through the atmosphere. But again, the atmosphere isn't thick enough for parachutes to be completely effective. So we need a secondary method of slowing the spacecraft down. And that's turned out to be rocket platforms on a descending spacecraft that can then slow the spacecraft enough so that it doesn't crash land on the surface.
Landing the craft and getting people there safely is only one part of the problem. You also have to protect them from the harsh conditions.
The space environment is not nice at all. Well, those humans have to be protected somehow from the harsh radiation environment. We need food for that crew. We need water for that crew. We need the medical supplies for that crew. We need air for that crew. We need some way to keep them occupied and busy so that they don't get bored.
And ideally, you have to think about the return trip as well.
Let's just say that when you land on Mars, it's not the softest landing, and something is broken on the spacecraft that does not allow it to take off again for the return trip. Now what do? We have to create a system that can function almost autonomously or can be repaired or operated independently by the crew, suffer through all those challenges of getting off the planet and coming back through space to land on Earth 3.5 years at the shortest later, and still maintain sanity.
Despite all of these unresolved challenges, the dream of getting humans to Mars persists. And beyond that, the idea of setting up a human colony there. In 2012, a Dutch entrepreneur named Bas Lansdorp announced the launch of a daring operation, Mars One.
I'm Bas Lansdorp. I'm a co-founder and CEO of Mars One. And we're organizing a manned mission to Mars in the year 2023.
Bas planned to choose regular people for this mission, not astronauts, a total of 24. The project would be funded by turning the selection process into a reality TV show, with audience members getting a chance to vote on who would get to go.
And these people are going to stay there the rest of their lives. So it's a one-way ticket, yes.
A one-way ticket? Who on Earth would sign up for this mission? To go to Mars, set up shop there, and never return? Reporter Liz Tung has this profile on two of the people who were ready and eager to make that trip.
Ron and Layla Zucker first met back in 1987 at Johns Hopkins University. Layla was a freshman, Ron was a recent graduate. And they pretty much hit it off right away. Because, Ron says, of a very deep and important thing that they shared.
We're both geeks.
Yeah, geeks are born, you're not made. We met basically through the Johns Hopkins Science Fiction Association, which was the geek club.
At a school of geeks.
At a school, at John, yeah.
We were the geekiest of the geeks.
The geekiest geeks at the geek school, yes.
These days, Layla's an ER doc and Ron's in cybersecurity. But in their spare time, they still love geeking it up, especially with one shared obsession.
We're both space junkies. We're the sorts of people who watch rocket launches. And we both actually believe in exploration and don't believe that the government is going to do it.
So in 2013, when Ron first heard that there was this project looking for ordinary people to send to Mars, he knew he had to tell Layla.
So I sent her an email saying, I don't really want you to go, but on the other hand, I'd be a terrible husband if I didn't at least tell you about it.
Some people would be upset if their spouse invited them to consider a one-way trip to Mars, but not Layla. Her first reaction?
When is the deadline and do I have time to finish the application in time?
What I find amazing about this anecdote is that neither of them hesitated, like at all. Both Ron and Layla have dreamed of going into space for pretty much as long as they can remember. It turned out Ron couldn't apply. He didn't meet the requirements. But Layla did. In fact, she'd actually applied to become an astronaut once before, like officially applied with NASA. Nothing had panned out yet, but here, all of a sudden, was a fresh chance to not only go into space, but to be one of the very first humans on Mars. So Layla got to work on her application. Now, remember, Mars One was going to be funded through a reality show. So part of the application involved sending in a video of yourself.
Why would I be the perfect candidate for this mission to Mars? Well, as long as I have work, games, and books, I'm never bored and I'm happy. I like to eat cold soup straight out of the can. I don't mind cramped spaces. I even have a superpower. I can sleep soundly anywhere, anytime.
There was stiff competition, at least according to Mars One, which said that over 200,000 people from around the world applied. Some people, by the way, have disputed that number, claiming it was only several thousand. But either way, I found it kind of shocking that anyone was interested, considering what they were signing up for. Abandoning everything they've ever known and loved to essentially die on a distant planet. So I kept asking Ron and Layla, doesn't that idea scare you? Wouldn't you miss each other? But Ron and Layla seemed totally unconcerned. They told me they don't see themselves as a single unit, but as two individuals who choose to be together. And Ron is very conscious of the fact that the time they do have together is limited, no matter what.
Look, at one point, somebody looked at me when they were talking about it and said, but if she goes, she'll die. And my instant response was, and if she stays, she'll live forever? Because if so, I'm down with it. If so, then I will try to convince her not to go. Our time on Earth is limited. We don't get that long. And I don't believe in an afterlife. But we have our time and that's it. Do something with it. Do something that matters to you. This matters to her, so I don't want to get in the way of that. If I wanted to get in the way of that, I never would have married her.
This was a conversation Ron had a number of times, including with a woman named Anne. She was the wife of another applicant they'd gotten to know. And Anne, understandably, had some pretty strong feelings about her husband applying to Mars One.
She was really hurt by it. The idea that he would walk away from her and the kids to volunteer to, let's be honest, die on a faraway place.
Her husband's name is Dan Carey. He's 59 and pretty much the definition of stable. He works as a data modeler, is an attentive father to their two grown kids, and has been together with Anne for almost 40 years.
My wife, you know, one day she came home from work and she says, you know, I must be stupid, but it's only just now occurring to me that, you know, you're willing to leave me to do this thing, you know? And so, you know, that initiated a lot of conversation.
The thing Dan kept trying to explain to his wife was that, yes, of course he loved her and the kids, and he would never even think of leaving them for anything else. But Dan had dreamed of going into space ever since he was a kid. The whole space program lit up his imagination.
You know, for me, there was that idea that you are doing something for mankind, broadly speaking, or humankind, that, you know, it's that thing larger than yourself.
As Dan got older, the dream fizzled away. But when he heard about Mars One, all those old feelings came rushing back. So one night, at dinner with his wife and two kids, Dan announced that he was thinking of applying. And his family was cool with it. After all, it seemed unlikely he'd be chosen.
None of us really thought that I would advance in the selection process. As my wife put it, what would they want with a 50-year-old data guy?
But Dan went for it anyway. He spent weeks thinking about what to put in his application before finally sending it in. A few months went by, and then on December 30th, 2013, he got the news. He'd made it past the first round. That's when things with his family, and his wife especially, took a turn.
She was worried that having crossed that Rubicon, having found something, you know, that I was willing to leave her and the kids for, and granted, the kids are adults, but, you know, if I was willing to do that for one thing, what else might it be?
So Dan started to really question himself. Was this what he wanted? Was he really willing to give up everything? His wife and kids, seeing the birth of his grandchildren. What would become of their relationships?
Did you think about how you would keep in touch with your family? And was that something that you talked about with them?
Yeah, certainly something that I thought about. And we did talk about it, although not a lot, because I think Anne and the kids didn't like to dwell on it.
As it turns out, it's not so easy communicating between Mars and Earth. There would be no phone calls, no Zoom or FaceTime, basically no talking in real time. Mostly, they'd have to keep in touch over email. As space geeks, Layla and Ron knew well what the communication situation would be. And Ron had already mentally prepared himself.
You know, I plan to have letters like the Ken Burns documentary on the Civil War. My dearest Layla. you know, but I also recognize, you know, it was going to be limited. And that's okay. You know, you're doing something important. Doing something important is just always worth it.
Layla thought so too, despite the fact that she knew her odds of surviving as one of the first Mars colonists would be pretty grim.
I think life will be short, nasty, and brutish for the first people on Mars. And I don't think you're going to live long enough to really get too worried about it.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk so casually about their own death before. Layla says she just doesn't think about it. Somehow, over the years, she's retained that feeling you have as a teenager that you'll live forever. And anyway, she says, on Mars, she'd probably be too busy trying to survive to worry about dying.
Every waking moment would be checking the air filters and breaking down the chemicals to make your oxygen and, you know, breaking down your water. All the things that would be necessary to stay alive on Mars would consume your every waking moment.
As for Dan, he said he wasn't afraid of death either. Not exactly.
The process of dying doesn't particularly scare me. It's that the gripping thing about when I think about death is what you won't get to do or experience once you're gone. You won't get to see your children's lives continue, you know, that sort of thing. That's the real pull on the heart.
In the meantime, Dan and Layla got closer and closer to being chosen. They both made it past the first cut around the end of 2013, along with about 700 other people. Over the next year, Mars One continued narrowing the field. Finally, in February 2015, the big announcement came. It selected their final 100 candidates, and both Dan and Layla had made the cut. At this point, it seemed like they were in the home stretch of the selection process. The idea was to sequester them away in some desert-like hideout, where they could test how well the applicants would deal with conditions like small spaces and isolation. But before they could get that far, something else happened. The mission essentially folded.
Mars One Ventures has filed for bankruptcy.
It wasn't exactly a surprise. There'd always been skepticism about Mars One. made worse when a couple MIT students released a study that pointed out multiple problems with the Mars One plan. It even predicted that within 68 days of landing, the colonists would all be dead. There were also money problems. Investors failed to materialize, and Mars One pushed back its blastoff date again and again. Within a couple years, Mars One was dead. Or almost dead. Layla and Dan say the founder, Boz Lansdorp, is still looking for investors. And as long as that's happening, they'll keep a tiny flame of hope burning.
It's an exceedingly infinitesimal chance that it could happen, but it is a non-zero chance.
But the dream of going to Mars, it wasn't a waste, according to Layla. She says what Mars One did was it created a conversation. It put the idea of going to Mars on the public's radar, and not just the public.
After Mars One announced, within 6 months, people, even NASA, was starting to talk about Mars.
As for Layla, she hasn't given up. She's still applying to competitions that she hopes will one day send her into space. Dan, on the other hand, has had to accept that his window of opportunity has probably closed. He'll be in his 60s soon. Too old, he says, for adventures in space. But Dan hasn't given up on the idea of space exploration. In fact, as we were ending our conversation, he said something that finally made the whole project click for me. Why anyone would want to leave their lives and loved ones to go die on a distant planet. Why humans going to Mars matters at all. He says it's not because we're destroying Earth and need a backup plan, though that may be true.
You know, but also it's that, it is that fundamentally optimistic view that spreading out is what life does. You know, life with a capital L. You know, it's always looking for a new niche, for a new place to spread, a new opportunity to get a foothold and reproduce and grow. And I think Mars will be the first step in humanity becoming the vector by which not just humans, but much of life on Earth will move out into the solar system.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. You're listening to Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse. Coming up, if we get people to Mars, what will they eat there?
Not everyone is accustomed to eating them as a food source, but that was the first crop that I did, and it did the best.
That's still to come.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. If humans got to the red planet and were actually able to stay there for a while, one of the next big questions would be what they would eat. What could they grow that would thrive under these severe conditions? Reporter Buffy Gorilla visited a greenhouse where researchers are trying to figure that part out.
It's dark in the greenhouse, but I can see some plants growing in trays on metal tables.
We had all of this.
That's great. Edward Guinan started this project as part of a class in 2017. He's a professor of astrophysics and planetary science at Villanova University near Philadelphia. The goal was to try and grow all kinds of crops in conditions retrofitted to resemble Mars.
Overall, you get about 60% of the total energy of light over the Martian year. We do try to have plants that don't mind shade.
So it's dark, it's cold, and Mars is covered in something called regolith. It's a type of iron-rich dirt that gives it its signature red look, but it's also full of harmful chlorides.
Perchlorates are a poisonous, they're hazmat, and they're on the Martian soil, anywhere from 0.1% to 1%. People think they're left over from the lakes and oceans that used to be there.
Ed's research doesn't use authentic Martian soil. None has ever been returned to Earth. But NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientists developed something called Mars Regolith Simulants that can be purchased online. And thanks to iron oxides, it's still reddish.
Alicia, come in. Oh, I'm glad you made it. Yeah, this is Alicia.
Hi, Alicia.
Alicia Eglin got involved in this project as part of her classwork. She recently graduated with a degree in astrophysics and astronomy.
Things that grow best tend to be plants with shallow roots. So anything like root vegetables that might be more hardy for a diet kind of struggle when it comes to regolith-based agriculture. So you have to look at alternatives for those.
One suggestion from Ed was nutritious, shallow-rooted kale. His students were not into it.
They said, I don't want to grow kale. I don't like it.
Ed planted kale, but his students planted hops. The hops thrived and became a bit of an international sensation. You can probably imagine the headlines. Beer on Mars. Ed says that while the hops may have put his project on the map, there were more interesting things happening. And besides hops?
So worthless, you know, except for beer, flavoring beer. It took over the whole roof of the greenhouse. We had to cut it down.
But all the attention from the hops led to new experiments. People from around the world sent Ed ideas about what crops to plant next. Suggestions for peanuts and Jerusalem artichokes came in.
They grew extremely well. They were growing out of their containers.
They experimented with hydroponics, growing plants in water. Ed grew ginger and a carrot successfully in a nutrient-rich solution. Using this system, Alicia made a discovery of her own.
The biggest, I think, surprise for other people is dandelion greens. Not everyone is accustomed to eating them as a food source, but that was the first crop that I did, and it did the best in the hydroponic system. They grew really big. They're really nutritious for you. Dandelions are great because you can eat the entire plant. So when you're on Mars, you want to minimize waste.
The team also came up with another idea, using the mighty earthworm to improve the Martian soil.
It's kind of a twofold benefit. You can have the worms in the Martian regolith, which is really important because they can help to transform it from like that sandy clay-like texture into an actual soil more similar to Earth through the introduction of organic matter in the worm castings. But then also you can take those worms and then eat them and turn that into a source of protein.
How do you prepare the worms to actually taste good? This is a challenge that you have not yet seen on any cooking programs, but Ed has already tried it.
I push the poop out of them, and then I fried them like hell until they looked almost crisp. A lot of garlic salt. So I couldn't taste anything. I just tasted like French fries. It worked. I didn't get sick, and I wouldn't make it like an everyday meal. Worms are full protein. You should try them.
That story was reported by Buffy Gorilla. Throughout the show, we've been hearing from astronomer Derek Pitts, and I wanted to ask him one last question. If you had to put money on this, when do you think we might get to Mars? What year would you pick? Manned mission.
SpaceX has made huge strides in a really short period of time. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that there are some people that are foolish enough to try to make a trip to Mars by 2035.
Wow, that's soon.
Yeah, that's why I say foolish. Now, NASA, on the other hand, I'm going to say it's going to be 2040. Before NASA gets close to sending people to Mars.
Derek Pitts is chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. You've been listening to Destination Mars, a special production from The Pulse at WHYY. We're a weekly health and science show. To hear more episodes, just subscribe to The Pulse wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Hannah Fulmer is our intern. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lizarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.